This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I'm Mira Sivasodi. It's our Health and Living segment. And today we've got the other monthly open clinic segment. And today's open clinic segment is going to be around sleep problems. So you can ask your doctor who's in the studio with us today anything you want to know about sleep issues. The number to call, 7733 2900. You can WhatsApp 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. So in the house with us, Dr. Jeevanan Jahendran. He's a consultant, ear, nose and throat surgeon. He's going to be helping us answer your questions. Welcome to the show, Dr. Jeevanan. How are you today?
I'm fine, and thank you for having me here today.
You're most welcome. I just have one question before we move into questions.
Yeah.
You're an ENT specialist. What's your expertise? What does it have to do with sleep issues, you know?
Well, there's a very close interrelationship between breathing and sleep. And one of the commonest sleep disorders that we see is sleep apnea. But sleep apnea is just the tip of the iceberg. There are a whole gamut of, a whole range of breathing disorders that actually lead on, or, you know, you can progress on from snoring. And there's a lot of other diseases that are actually associated with it. So if you look at sleep disorders, based on the current classification, there are about 100 over different sleep disorders. And the thing is, different specialties look at it. So I have to make a disclaimer here that what we are looking at is primarily a sleep breathing disorder. So things like insomnia, things like parasomnia, sleepwalking, restless leg, these are all different, they come under different categories of sleep disorder. But as you get more and more, you sleep more and more of this, a lot of it is actually interrelated. There's a lot of complex interplay and integration between a lot of these areas. But primarily, as an ENT, we look at sleep disordered breathing as one part of all sleep disorders.
And would you say sleep breathing disorders are make up a huge chunk of the tons of other sleeping disorders?
It is almost 90% of all sleep. Yeah.
Okay.
So that's primarily the among sleep, the breathing disorders, OSA is probably one of the most commonest ones that we deal with.
Okay. So let's let me quickly understand this. When do we start experiencing breathing issues, which inevitably could cause a sleep problem?
Oh, that's a Pandora's box question. So to basically classify this, I'll talk about adults first. Now, basically, as an adult, if you're looking at breathing disorders, we look at symptoms like snoring, poor sleep quality, fragmented sleeps, when they tend to move a lot in their sleep, they wake up feeling tired, they feel sleepy during the day, even diseases like high blood pressure, heart problems, you know, rhythm disorders of the heart, they all have an underlying cause which may be related to a sleep breathing disorder. So people should get tested, or they need to be assessed for this condition. In children, it's a different ballgame. In children, they present with anything but a breathing disorder. So you see things like a child, you know, I call them like, you know, they're like helicopter moving all over the bed. They kick, they grind their teeth, they can have bed wetting, they are hyperactive. They tend to have very short attention span, poor concentration. So these are all symptoms of a breathing disorder. And we need to identify these kids more than anything else. And that's where the work that I do, I integrate this with a lot of dental colleagues, because they are able to pick up these patients very, very well. Because when they look at the skeletal structure, you know that something is wrong. And that actually leads to things like mouth breathing. And when you have mouth breathing, that is almost the precursor of a lot of other things that comes down the line. You know, your posture gets bad and everything else comes after that.
Mm-hmm.
So I like to put it in a way like, you know, when structure goes wrong as a growing child, your function is compromised, and then you adapt to these changes. And when you adapt to these changes, as a young person, you don't see these symptoms.
Yeah.
And you grow with these symptoms, and later on you start getting other things coming in, you know. I have difficulty falling asleep. I can't focus. I get up. I get angry. I get irritable. I have all these, you know, depression, anxiety. All these are breathing-related symptoms. But unfortunately, we are, as doctors, we are all very, very compartmentalized. If somebody's got anxiety, they see a psychiatrist or a psychologist. Somebody who has got a posture-related issue, they get their posture thing sorted out. But the human body is a single unit. And what we need to understand is there's a lot of integration between all these systems. And when we approach this disease, we have to be very holistic in our approach.
So if you talk about structure, it's really something that's beyond our control, wouldn't you say? Because you said structure's gone wrong. I mean, how would we know, right? A lot of us, if we have dental issues, we go to the orthodontist and fix it and we think we're wonderful and all good to go. That might not be the case.
It's a very controversial area, and the orthodontists still feel that, you know, this is an area where, but they're not very convinced about it. But there is literature that's coming up. There's evidence that's actually coming up. So it's not a definitive science. It's still a learning science. And you said very rightly that you can't control these things because, number one, if there's one thing that you cannot choose in life, it's your parents. So if your parents are skeletally, you know, they're structurally not correct, then you're going to have, the child's going to have certain features of the parents, and they're already predisposed. I give you an example. I saw a patient just yesterday, and when I was talking to him about his symptoms, he says, "Doc, you just explained exactly what my father's actually going through now." As I said, because you look like your dad, you know? So.
Okay. Looks like, you know, if you, you know, everything, just blame your parents. Like, you know, like anything and everything, just blame your parents.
Yeah, same thing with allergies as well.
Yes, everything. Hypertension, diabetes, most of the time, it's all in the family, isn't it? Okay, we have a caller. Zoe has a question. Zoe, how are you today?
Hello. I'm good, thank you. How are you?
I'm very well. What's your question?
I have so many dreams throughout the night, so they are causing me trouble to get good quality sleep. And what should I do about it?
Okay. Can we ask how old Zoe is? Zoe,
if you don't mind.
Sorry?
How old are you, Zoe?
I'm 25.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thanks, Zoe.
Thank you.
Having many dreams at night, actually having dreams during REM sleep is actually a good thing because it tells you that you're actually getting restorative sleep. But having many dreams and it's really affecting, and it's bad dreams and it can lead on to night terrors or nightmares, tells us that there's something not right. So you need to look at your sleep hygiene. Now, this concept of sleep hygiene is, are you sleeping at the same time every day? Are you waking up at the same time every day? How are your eating patterns? Make sure that you don't eat too late. Don't take any stimulants before you go to sleep. These are very general things that we are talking about. And the other thing is, are you on any prescription medications? That's one thing that we need to know. So all these things we need to look at. And as far as dreams, if it's more like terrors and you feel like, it's something that's waking you up, then definitely we need to look at whether you have a breathing disorder as well. Because one of the things is breathing disorders can give rise to things like this.
And when she comes to, let's say she comes to see you, Dr. Jivanan, I mean, you would go through like a checklist as to, you know, what...
We basically start from pretty much from childhood. We look at an allergy history, whether they've got allergic rhinitis, asthma, you know, whether they've got features of mouth breathing. We look at posture. All these things need to be addressed. And then we look at the upper airway. We assess the upper airway. And then, of course, we look at all the various parameters that we talked about, the health aspects of sleep, whether they're actually doing it. The big problem now that we have is people tend to be on screen time, you know, screen time. Then, and again, what kind, are you watching movies or anything like that before you go to bed? Because if you're watching things like horror movies or action pack, I mean, all these things can have an impact on your sleep. So you've got to look at, there's a lot of things that we need to look at and then sort of build a picture, and you need to be properly assessed.
Okay. You don't want to mess with the Dr. Jivanan, because I'm meeting him for the first time and I walked up and I sat down in front of him and he already knew I had sleeping issues. So that's how powerful this man is. He knows from your posture to the overcrowding in the mouth to everything. You don't mess around with him. He knows exactly what you're talking about. So if you have a question on sleep issues, give us a call. It's 7733 2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, or tweet us at BFM Radio. Now, this next message is about why do I feel still feel tired during the day, even though I sleep at least 8 hours at night?
Well, as far as sleep is concerned, there are two very important aspects that you need to take into consideration. Number one is duration. So, you know, as kids, you need a longer duration, but we're going to stay with adults. You need at least 7 to 9 hours of sleep. Minimum 7, maximum 9. Anything less, anything more, not a good thing. So, but the duration itself is not enough. You need good quality sleep. So, people need to understand that sleep is not a process where your body is actually shutting down and you're going to rest. It's not. Sleep is an active process. It's like when you go and work out in the gym, you're putting your heart through the paces and you're trying to get fit. You have to have that same kind of idea about sleep. Sleep is an active process. So you sort of prepare yourself to fall asleep, and then your body goes through different stages of sleep, and then your body actually repairs itself. So all this is an active process. Now, what are the things that can affect sleep? Now, if you're the kind of person who has a very high-strung life and you carry your work home, you're running around the whole day, you take coffee at the wrong periods, you take a lot of stimulants at the wrong times of the day, you have late meals, you don't eat.
Like that's most of us.
Exactly. This is exactly what I'm saying. So if you understand that, do you know the number of people who are actually walking around with sleep disorders? So me included, because I've got horrible sleep hygiene, and I openly tell that. And over the last 5 years, I've made a very significant effort to actually correct that. And believe it or not, if I tell you, you want to lose weight, sleep well. Because regulations of hormone that actually controls your appetite and, you know, does all, it's all related to sleep. So many things happen during sleep. Your cells actually, you know, they sort of regenerate itself. You're getting restful sleep. So it sort of prepares you for the next day. And it's not like, you know, I compromise today and I'll do more tomorrow. Would you say like, okay, today I'm going to the gym and I'll take it easy. Tomorrow I'll double the effort. It's a total waste of time. So it has to be a very regulated, very, you know, you need to do it properly. Now, how many people, you know, have TV screens in their bedrooms?
Tons.
That's bad, because that itself is going to, how many people pick up their phone and look at it before they go to sleep? That's all these are going to stimulate your mind. And, you know, one of the best things, the best experiment I tell my patients to do, I said, you feel very sleepy, go and sit in front of a computer and check your email for 5 minutes and tell me if you're sleepy after that. You're wide awake. So these are habituations that we are paying the price for modern society. Mm-hmm. Whether we like it or not, this is definitely one of the things that we need to look at. So we need to correct all these things.
Okay. W. Ching is asking, my husband, who's 53 years old, says he doesn't sleep well the entire night, but she hears him snoring. Her question is, so did he sleep or not? She's doubting his not getting enough sleep.
I know where this is coming from, because I hear this all the time. And when they tell their husbands, when they actually have snoring, the husband says, no, there's nothing wrong with me, I'm okay. And it works vice versa as well. So, no, he's not getting good sleep. The problem is when you snore, your brain is, you see, snoring basically indicates that your airway is actually blocked, all right? Now, when your airway is blocked, it depends on the intensity of the snoring. So even though any amount of snoring is actually not good, any snoring is not good. So it basically indicates that your airway is actually closing up on itself. Now, when it's closing and you're not getting enough air, your body actually senses it and your brain actually tells your diaphragm to move to tell you to breathe. So your brain doesn't shut. I mean, your brain is continuously working and you go into this cycle of, you know, breathing, not breathing, breathing, not breathing, or partially breathing. And when you wake up feeling not rested. You wake up feeling tired. You feel as if you want to sleep a little bit more. All these are very classic symptoms of somebody who's got a sleep disordered breathing. So when we look at snoring, I mean, I was just telling you earlier, you know, for me, I'm biased as an ENT surgeon, but I said, what is chest pain to a cardiologist is snoring to me, because the moment you snore when you're tired, it already indicates that your airway is compromised. So if you look at our patients, you know, they generally progress from snoring when they're tired or they have a couple of drinks, and then when they lie flat, they snore, and then the wife pushes them to one side or the partner pushes them to one side, they're quiet for a while. And then a few years down the line, it doesn't matter whichever position you push them, they're snoring in whatever position. And then they become heroic snorers. When they snore inside the room, people either outside or downstairs can hear them. And then they'll come and tell you that, hey, doc, actually now he snores. Sometimes he snores and then he's quiet for a while and then he chokes a little bit and then he snores again. So I'm like, okay, that's bad, because that quiet silence means that he's not breathing. And you will be surprised that some of the sleep studies that I do, I've had patients who stop breathing for 90 seconds.
That's a long time.
Yes. And when you actually tell them to hold their breath for 90 seconds, they can't do it. But their airway is so bad that they actually collapse. I've got, when we measure something called apnea hypopnea index and a lot of other criteria when we do a sleep study, I think my record holder was 125 times in an hour.
Wow.
And I've seen patients at 112, 90, 70, 60, and the normal is less than 5. So these patients did not develop sleep apnea overnight. This is something that has progressed over a long period of time. So people really need to be aware that breathing and sleep are very closely interrelated, and they really have to do this properly. And it affects every system and every part of the body. We don't look at breathing as something that's important. We take it for granted. So when my patients come and I tell them they have a breathing problem, so they said, no, I think I'm all right. I said, that's because the day you have a breathing problem is the day you're dead.
Yes, of course. Okay, I'm really now very worried about this. Breathing issues, sleep problems, give us a call in the studio with us, Dr. Jeevanan Jahindran, a consultant ENT surgeon. We're discussing everything you need to know about sleep. Give us a call. It's 7733 2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, or tweet us at BFM Radio. Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Mira Sivasodhi. It's our Health and Living segment and it's our monthly open clinic with ENT surgeon Dr. Jeevanan Jahindran. We're discussing sleep problems and he looks very much at sleep disordered breathing. You were saying more than 90% of sleeping disorders are actually sleep disordered breathing issues. So if you have a question, give us a call. The number is 7733 2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, or tweet us at BFM Radio. We've got a question here, Dr. Jeevanan. After sleeping for an hour or so, I wake up and I'm unable to fall back to sleep till dawn. I suspect I need melatonin, but I can't buy it at local pharmacies. I understand my cortisol production is low in the early hours. I have a phobia of going to bed early, but I usually go to bed after midnight. Can you please advise? Wow, this person has actually explored quite a bit, hasn't he?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes, he knows what he's talking about. It sounds very much that he's got insomnia. So insomnia has got two things, and this is actually more of a psychiatric domain, and I don't deal so much with it, but basically when you have insomnia, it means that you either have problems falling asleep or you have problems, you fall asleep, wake up, and you can't go back to sleep. It's not as easy. It's prescribing melatonin is the easy way out. And definitely taking sleeping pills is something that I would be very, very cautious, because that has got its own major problems as well. So to deal with something like this, normally I'll refer it. We need to look at a lot of mental health. We look at things like that. And we look again at sleep hygiene. Breathing-related disorders, again, is something that we need to exclude. Mouth breathing, anxiety, all these things are things that we look at. So you need to have a good assessment of it. And then there's also a lot of psychological issues. And in fact, we were talking just yesterday, I was listening to one of my colleagues from US, and he was talking about how childhood psychological trauma can actually cause these kind of things. And it's a huge area that we go into. So one of the things that we actually do to actually improve melatonin secretions is actually to train people how to breathe correctly. And even things like yoga actually helps. But you really need to look at sleep hygiene. You need to look at work patterns, whether they're sleeping during the day, whether they're shift workers. All these things have got an impact as well. So that's very, very important to look at. Again, it's a question that we cannot answer straight off. It's not a straightforward answer. But these are the things that you need to look at and you need to be assessed.
Okay. Cheryl is asking, my six-year-old son has all the classic symptoms that you have described, helicopter sleeping, hyperactive, grinding teeth, he snores as well. Is he going to need surgery or something drastic like that?
It's always a question of whether surgery or not. And I think that's a very, very loaded question.
It's like the dreaded word, really.
Correct. So I look at it this way, all right? He's definitely got an obstruction to his airway. Now, we need to figure out why is he obstructed. There are many reasons to this. Number one, we look at the development of the jaw. So things that would affect the development of the jaw is early bottle feeding, lack of breastfeeding, using pacifiers, thumb sucking, and a lot of these issues may be related to the tongue posture. And this actually results in breathing issues. And this is where the dentist actually comes in, because they can pick out a lot of these things. And you have to look for what I call as an atopic background. I use this word atopy because when we use the word allergy, patients get wrong misconceptions. They think that it's an, you know, you have your own idea of what an allergy is. But when we talk about atopy, atopy basically means an hyperactive immune system. And they normally go down a progression from colic, atopic dermatitis, bronchiolitis, asthma, and allergic rhinitis. Allergic rhinitis is what everybody refers to as normal sinus, you know, the early morning flu. And so when they use terms like this, and both sides need to be blamed, doctors and patients, because we use these terms and patients catch on it. But they're very specific terminology. And all this whole spectrum of disease actually causes a lot of immune-mediated response. And the immune system that sits in the upper airway gets enlarged and they get swollen. And this is part of the reason why their breathing is actually compromised. So we need to identify the cause and we need to address the cause. And addressing the cause means you need to look at diet, you need to look at environment, you know, if they've got pets at home, if there's a smoker at home. All these things are very, very important. So we need to look at this whole picture before we even think about surgery. But when you need to do surgery, you must always look at it. When I discuss this with patients, right, I said, when you already have that impression at the back that you're not going to do surgery, you want to try everything else, it's like sending somebody to go to a war and then said, I'll let you go to war first with sticks and stones. And then after that, if that doesn't work, I'll throw a stone and, you know, and then you progress. And if everything doesn't work, then I'll talk about doing surgery. It shouldn't be like that, because it should be very clear that you need to treat what is appropriate. So first of all, find out what the underlying cause, deal with it. And if there is something that needs to be surgically corrected, you need to discuss this and you need to, don't jump into surgery as your primary, this one. Because when we talk about adenoids and tonsils, that's a whole different issue altogether. Because we now know that if you're removing your adenoids and tonsils for a patient who is not breathing correctly, it may not be the complete answer. So you really have to assess again, you really have to discuss the options. And don't, surgery is something like a quick fix. Don't go down that path. Find out what the reasons are first. You do surgery with a partner that's smoking at home, you're basically cutting out something and you're putting back the child in the same environment and things are going to go back to square one. So you need to look at the bigger picture. But surgery is not the, I wouldn't say it's not the answer, but if you need it, you need to do it.
Okay, but you need to look at
You need to
else.
Look at the big, yes.
Okay. Right. John, you have a question.
Yeah, hello?
Yes, go ahead, John.
Yeah, okay. I'd like to ask, basically, I have difficulty breathing, especially when I sleep. And when I wake up, I have terrible, very, very terrible dry mouth. And I could feel like, you know, my lungs are somewhat tired. But the most, my main major complaint is the morning anxiety, like terrible, like, you know, just wake up in the morning, just feeling absolutely terrible.
Thank you,
John. Because you know what? The reason Dr. Jeevanan and I are laughing is because these are the exact things he asked me when we were chatting outside about me. So there you go. Now, Dr. Jeevanan, please answer John. Thank you for the question, John.
John, just give me an age range. How old are you roughly?
I'm 29. And I also must mention that I think I have a deviated
septum.
Let me see if I can get a lot of these things correct. Okay, first of all, do you have an allergic background?
Oh no, he's gone off. Yeah, sorry about that.
All right,
that's okay. You want to just answer the question?
All right. Well, it is a very classic. It's a very classic case that we would see, because he's probably got crowding of teeth. He's probably got a very high palate. He's got underlying issues that actually has caused developmental issues with a posture issue. So that's one of the reasons why he's got a deviated septum. But his mouth breathing is an adaptation from the narrow breathing passage. So he's been mouth breathing for a very, very long time. And as you can see, this will probably result in a lot of fragmented sleep. So they get not restful sleep. But he's 20 plus. So he doesn't see that effects of it yet. So you take somebody at 20 plus and you tell them to stay awake the whole night and go to work the next day. And you take that same patient 10 years down the line and ask him to do. So you see, all of these things that they have are basically an adaptive process. And this didn't start immediately. This started as he was a growing child. So I will go back to his history. I would look at what he did as a child, the allergic background, the whole works. So here we have, this is a classic patient which I would, this is something that I would talk, but a lot of people in my fraternity still don't see this yet, and it's still very controversial. But his deviated nasal septum, though, is the problem that's causing the nasal obstruction. His main issue is he's breathing through his mouth. So it's a structural problem that has led to a functional compromise, which has led to an adaptation. His mouth breathing is a habit now. So if I go in and correct his nasal septum without getting him to correct his breathing, he's not going to get better.
No.
And I really would want to sit down and look at his posture, and I would want to sit down and look at his dentition, and I would look at the crowding of the teeth, whether he's had any dental work done before. All these are very important things to me. So if I see that crowding and he's had previous things like impacted wisdom tooth, which has been removed because of horizontally placed, or if he's had what we call as, four-tooth removal with braces, all these things are very important things that we need to look at. And then we need to overall look at the skeletal structure and look at his function and then assess it and do it. And the reason for the anxiety is mouth breathing. So once we correct his functional, once we correct his breathing, so we look at myofunctional therapy, which is something that's relatively new. It's training the lips and the tongue to sit and in the correct position so that they're able to breathe correctly. And then we even talk about breathing techniques. So these patients, if some of them are actually yoga practitioners, they already know that they have a problem. So they do meditation, yoga, to try and overcome these things. But because skeletally they're not correct, you cannot achieve good results. So you need to correct everything in an integrated manner.
I don't understand the link to anxiety.
Sorry?
I don't understand the link to anxiety.
The link to anxiety, it may be chemical driven. Because when we actually breathe through our mouth, there's something that goes on in the brain that actually, you know, triggers this whole response, and they wake up feeling. Let me put it to you the other way. When you're actually not breathing correctly, you're basically, if you imagine that you're choking or you're suffocating, it's the same response you would get if you're walking down a dark alley and somebody chases you. So you get into this flight or fright response, which is actually a cortisol-driven response. And that, when you have that during your sleep, you basically wake up, you carry on that chemical effect, and that's what gives you the anxiety. And untreated, this will give rise to more problems like panic attacks and further down the line, depression.
Okay. I have a question. Who doesn't have a deviated septum? It feels like everybody,
almost everybody you look inside the nose has a deviated septum, isn't it?
Yeah.
Now, If you look at the whole skeletal structure, right, of the whole skull, you've got to look at it as a double-story house, okay? And what you see from the mouth, the roof of the mouth, is actually the floor of the nose. So a lot of our patients, because we don't do things in a natural way when as a baby, we all get very small and constricted. The bone is called the maxilla. So what actually happens is, these are all, if you look at culturally, right, how our patients actually breastfed, a lot of our patients are not breastfed. A lot of our patients are actually bottle fed because parents, mothers are going back to work. So bottle feeding, thumb sucking, all these things cause constriction of the growth of the palate. And when the constriction of the growth of the palate happens, the roof of the palate actually goes up. And if you look at the room above, that room above has got a wall that separates your right and the left nose. So if your roof goes up, what's going to happen to your septum? Your septum is going to bend. But the degree of bend is what depends on whether you're going to have symptoms or not. And then throw in allergic rhinitis, atopy, all these things will cause a lot of swelling in your nose. And the problem with all this is, if you're treating them based on symptoms, that's when you're going to get into trouble. Because I call it the iceberg phenomenon. What you see is only 10%. What you don't see is 90%. The mouth breathing actually would now cause forward head posture, which actually tilts your body. You have a pelvic tilt. You have flat feet, temporomandibular joint dysfunction. There's so much of interrelationship between anything and everything that you can think of.
And how have we gone so wrong? Is it evolution or, you know, what's happened?
Evolution. We are paying the price for modernization. We are paying the price for pollution. We are paying the price for urbanization. Everybody in Klang Valley has got a breathing problem until proven otherwise, purely based on the fact of the quality of the air that we are breathing in. The MCO was really good because we actually realized what was good quality air. But we're back to square one again. So if you're breathing bad air, which is the organ that's going to pay the price? It's the nose. And the worst part is, we are not even using our nose. We're using our mouth to breathe.
Yeah.
And the nose is such a brilliant organ that the way it's designed, it's... See, your brain doesn't tell you to breathe through your nose or breathe through your mouth. Your brain actually tells your diaphragm to move and your chest wall to expand. And the pressure differential is actually what draws the air through the nose into your lungs. Now, if you imagine that conduit passage is very, very small, what's going to happen? So you're going to develop adaptations by learning how to breathe through your mouth, which should not happen. So when air flows through the nose, there's so many things that actually happen. The air is filtered, it's humidified, it's moistened, and then you have, you know, there's this concept of nitric oxide from your sinuses that actually come and mix with the air. And these actually helps you with oxygenation, improve oxygenation. And there are studies out there which actually tell you that you're supposed to breathe through your nose 96% of the time.
And we don't. How much are we using our nose?
We don't know.
Don't know.
And if you breathe through your mouth, you get 10 to 20% less oxygen than normal. So if you put this into perspective, you're doing this as a child and you're growing up with this, you're basically creating chronic inflammation, chronic oxidative stress. And here we are, you know, pumping ourselves with vitamins and supplements, and you know, people talk about all these things and it's such a, you know, gimmick. But when fundamentally, when we don't do things correctly, we are heading into trouble.
Yeah. So it's all got to do with your breathing.
Yep.
Absolutely. So we'll come back and continue this open clinic. If you have a question on sleep problems, Dr. Jeevan and Jahindran, consultant ENT surgeon in the studio with us, give us a call. It's 7733-2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, or tweet us at BFM Radio. Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Meera Sivasuthi. If you have just joined us, it's our monthly open clinic segment. Dr. Jeevan and Jayendran, consultant, ENT surgeon in the studio with me. And it's a Ask a Doctor site segment. Ask him anything you want about sleep problems. A lot of it to do with sleep disordered breathing is what Dr. Jeevan's specialty is. But it would seem like it's what's, you know, most of, you know, affecting most of us and our sleep, the reason we have sleep issues. So it's terribly enlightening, Dr. Jeevan, and we've spoken about evolution and how that has affected a lot of us in terms of structure as well, in terms of our breathing, pollution, as you said. It's a whole range of issues that have added to our sleeping problems. So we have some questions going. If you have other questions, please give us a call. It's 7733-2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, or tweet us at BFM Radio. Now, Muhammad Shahani has a question, and he's asking, how does smoking affect breathing? And I know Muhammad Shahani is a big advocate of, you know, anti-tobacco.
Yeah. All right. To give you an idea, if I need to work on a patient, and if they are smokers, I tell them, don't even bother going down the path if you don't stop smoking, because it's literally a total waste of time. I was the happiest person when I heard the government is removing duty-free taxes on smoking, because I think that is the way to go. When we breathe, there are three important things that we need to understand. First of all, we need to get air from the nose to the lungs. That's one part of respiration. Then in the lungs, you need to understand that air exchange has to take place. That means carbon dioxide comes out, oxygen goes in. It's very complex. Then there's a third part where your cells have to now extract this oxygen and convert them into energy. Now, if you smoke, even if you, whether you smoke one cigarette a day or whether you smoke one cigarette a week or one cigarette a year, it doesn't make a difference to me. Because it's a cumulative damage to your lungs. So first of all, if you're already having breathing disorders, air going in is already going to be a problem. And it looks like almost everybody's got this problem. When you damage your lung, the exchange is going to get compromised because of smoking. And then when you get less, your cells are going to get less, and you're basically wasting away your body. So if you're going to work on all these things, I think there's no brainer here. Don't smoke. Ask any doctor, they'll say no smoking.
So it's no point then.
Yeah. Because we do a lot of structural corrections in terms of operating on the nose and, you know, getting a little bit of space and stuff like that. Now, I tell them, I said, even if you need the surgery, I'm not going to do it, because it's absolutely no point. And this is so human nature, right? This person, A, who is a smoker, will say that he got the surgery done. He said, I was feeling good for about a year. And then after that, my symptoms came back again. Now, there'll be another non-smoker, a friend of his, who may actually benefit from the treatment. And if somebody suggests that you need to do nasal surgery, and he's going to tell this guy, don't do it because I did it and it came back again. Nobody puts the smoking into the equation, which I think is very, very unfair. So if you want to smoke, then go ahead. I've got nothing against people who want to smoke. But if you're going to suffer a disease, it's your responsibility.
Next question.
Can I also add another thing?
Yes, go ahead.
If a parent is smoking and if a kid has got this problem, then I have serious issues with this. Because a kid is now suffering because of the parent who's smoking. And if I'm going to put that child after treatment back into the environment, it's the same as not treating him. So my advice, even to young people, especially women whom they look for a partner, I tell them, find somebody who doesn't smoke. If you really don't want to give him up, then don't have kids.
Okay. Fair enough. Do men and women present differently with sleep issues when they come and see you?
Very different. Very, very different. It's a very good question because there was very recently that I've come across an article that was published last year in one of our journals. And what they did was they looked at male and female sleep apneic patients and they found that if you age match them, the males with a higher score have got less severe disease compared to females with a lower score with more severe disease, which is very interesting. Mm. Now, one of the things we actually begin to understand is when you ask questions of sleep apnea, it's things like, do you feel tired during the day? Do you feel lethargic during the day? Do you feel fatigued during the day? Yeah. We talked about this earlier. Now, that's a loaded question for a woman. To me, asking that question to a woman is like asking how heavy are you, because you're just asking for a slap. And the thing is, laziness, not doing anything is definitely a male trait. I'm a male and I'm so happy somebody has admitted it.
I'll admit it to the Klang Valley. Thank you, Dr. Devanan.
So that's a male trait. But if you ask a woman, if you're tired, they don't understand the meaning of the word tired because from the time they get up in the morning until the time they go to bed, they're on the go. They're running around behind kids, they're cooking, they're working, and you know, almost every woman I know is a working mom today, and they're literally exhausted by the end of the day. But interestingly, they found that women actually show up with more behavioral or rather mental health issues. They found that women tend to either be on medications for depression or anxiety with sleep disorders or sleep breathing disorders, which is very, very interesting for us. And you find that a lot of them have this is something purely from observation. They tend to be more driven, type A personality. They want to finish up things, but they're all mouth breathers and they've all got history of allergies. But when you ask them, they don't relate all these things. And one of the possible things may be hormonal. So as long as you're not menopausal, you may be masking those symptoms. But problem is, once you hit menopause, it's a lot of these patients, when you actually see them, in fact, I just saw one today, and she's been seeing so many doctors and nobody actually diagnosed her with a sleep breathing disorder. And all her problems started 2 years ago when she got menopausal, and then she started having progression of symptoms, and actually she's on an antidepressant now. So now I've got to sit down and, you know, work on the breathing, and then slowly in time, we'll probably take her off the antidepressant. I've got so many examples. I had a patient who actually wanted to jump out of a window. She came, she said, do something about it. Otherwise, this was years ago. And one look at her and I said, she's got sleep apnea. I had to admit her because, you know, the risk of her doing something, admitted her, did an in-house sleep study. In the ward itself, I put her on a CPAP machine. That's the treatment for sleep apnea in some patients. And 1 month later, when I saw her sitting in front of my clinic, I couldn't recognize her. Completely different personality. She was on 3 psychiatric medications for depression. And by the time we finished with her, she was on 1. So it makes a difference. It makes a huge difference.
Wow. Okay. Coming to see you, lah. How long? What's the wait list like?
Oh, it's very easy to give me. I have a very, very relaxed practice because I don't work too hard. It's only laziness is a meal treat.
Not after this show. You're going to be working.
I'm worried now.
You know, let's talk about naps. Does that really affect the quality of sleep at night? And do, you know, power naps help?
Yes, power naps do help. But when we say power naps, it's like 15 minutes, 10 minutes, you know, these kind of naps. It's like recharging your batteries. So it's like you drain your battery during the day and then you recharge it. So it definitely helps. But afternoon naps, like sleeping 2 hours in the afternoon, may not be a good idea. Because if you sleep in the afternoon, you're going to push your sleeping time even later. And then this is when you're going to have problems like falling asleep, you know, waking up in the middle of the night, then you can't go to sleep again. So there's something called sleep window, you know. If a lot of people will actually experience this, at night around 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock, and you'll feel like you're so sleepy. The moment you miss that window, and then suddenly you're wide awake, and then you can't sleep. So your body is actually programmed to tell you that it's time to go to bed. So don't miss that. Try not to miss that. If you miss that, then these are all sleep hygiene practices. So these are very important sleep hygiene practices that we should learn and, you know, cultivate. Children especially, you know, when I see children sleeping, you know, sometimes when you go out for a function and 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock, and you see children still out, I think this is very bad.
I mean, we've seen them at 1 a.m. at the mama restaurants, you know, when they were open. I'm like, you should be asleep.
Correct. And people don't realize that these kids are now, you're actually priming them for so many other problems later on, you know, and especially mental health. I mean, we talk about mental health, it's such a big thing. But the way you breathe, you had John talking about anxiety. Yeah. It's a mental health issue. But you see, there's so many issues that are related to this. There are so many underlying causes that we can look at. Mm-hmm. So we should really change the way we do things. I mean, go back to age-old practices of living healthy. That's what we want. I don't want to be treating sick people. I want to make sure that, you know, people are healthy.
You know, you spoke about adaptation. Everything, you know, you adapt, you know, from young, and then after a certain age, it hits you. So that's where the danger is, I think.
Correct.
You don't realize that this is actually happening. How Correct. Do you be more aware when you're younger?
Learn how to live healthy. Eat well, eat on time, sleep when you're supposed to sleep. I mean, it's not a boring life. I'm not telling you not to do these things, but everything has to be done in moderation. So know how to put things in place. I think, if you look at COVID, right, I think COVID was a very good reset button. It actually showed us that we don't have to do things the way we are doing. We can actually do things in a much more efficient manner. It will actually be much more healthier for us. I know so many of my doctor colleagues, they work like, it's like you're always chasing after something. You're always running after something, you know. Take a step back. Do what you have to do and you know, put your check and balance in place. That's how it needs to go. But again, as you mentioned, right, my big problem is I can see somebody who's very young and already know that this is going to lead down a problem much later on. But as far as the patient goes, they don't seem to think of it as a problem. They say, I'm fine. I've got no issues. I'm still doing this. I'm okay. But when you come later with the problem, why did you wait? Why do you actually want to go into a problem? You know?
So, earlier on, you spoke about 7 to 9 hours of sleep. Most of us need that. If you listen to videos by so-called spiritual people and gurus and swamijis and all of that, and they sleep, 3 hours? They just tell you, you don't need to sleep that long. Mm-hmm. So what is the, you know, so should you or should you not sleep 7 to 9 hours?
If you can be like the Swamiji and you can meditate and you can go into another plane of, you know, we call it mindfulness, yep, then you can work with 5 hours. See, it's very different, you know. We are not on the same level as them. But you see how they have attained a different level of mind control, mindfulness, mind, you know. There's so many things in yoga that we actually, you know, I'm not a yoga practitioner, but I'm now very, very interested because it looks like whatever they were talking 2,000 years ago actually made sense. But I'm now very curious because it looks like the two important things that tells me that a patient has a problem is breathing and posture. And that's exactly what yoga was talking about.
Well, there's qigong as well and all of that, yeah?
Yeah, exactly. In fact, the other day somebody sent me this and he said qigong talks about placing your tongue on the palate to sort of balance your meridian power or something to that extent. And I was like, here we are talking about putting the tongue in the right place so that serotonin is actually released in the brain, and scientific paper. But qigong was talking about it in a different way. So we should not, we are Western medicine practitioners, you know, and somehow we tend to, alternate medicine.
Yeah.
But sometimes I think we really need to have a sort of a broader, more holistic approach, and maybe we can integrate these things into our practice and, you know, see where it goes. Because at the end of the day, what do you want? You want healthy patients. whatever works, works, you know? And it shouldn't be a quick fix like, I can't sleep, pop a sleeping pill. I can't breathe, nasal surgery. You know, everything is so compartmentalized today, and that's where we are heading into problems.
Okay, so the last question here. If someone's written in to say, I feel so stressed out at work that I have to rely on sleeping pills to fall asleep, are there any other methods that could help me deal with insomnia caused by stress? And I think this will relate, a lot of people will be able to relate to this. Where would be the starting point for a problem like this, Dr. Jeevanan?
Again, back to sleep hygiene. Make sure you don't have a sleep breathing disorder. Make sure you're breathing correctly. If you have allergies, all that needs to be looked at and it needs to be treated in a very holistic way. And again, once you see, we don't respond to stress, or we find it difficult to respond to stress because our adaptations, as I would put it, is not tuned to handling these kind of situations. So once we correct structure, correct function, everything will sort of fall into place.
Okay, one more question. We breathe through our mouths when we swim. Is swimming a good exercise?
Swimming is a good exercise, and yes, you breathe through your mouth, but it's not like we are living in the water and you're doing that. You do it as an exercise. So that's not going to change the way you breathe. When you're swimming, you do it. But when you come back, you breathe through your nose. But when people work out in the gym, you see, if you realize that a lot of people are not breathing correctly, they're actually using their mouth to breathe. Yes, you can use your mouth, but if you actually read, even for exercise, running and all that, you can actually control your breathing and breathe through your nose. You can do it, but the problem is when you're structurally or you're adapting, you will automatically go to it's like the path of least resistance.
Okay. So I asked you earlier, who doesn't have a deviated septum? It would seem like most of us do, dependent on how badly it's deviated. Then my question is, who doesn't have a breathing problem?
It is very, very, you know, it looks like at some point in time, everybody will have. So my dictum is, everybody has a breathing problem until proven otherwise.
Otherwise. Okay, fair enough. And, you know, there's so many issues around it. That was great. Thank you so much for enlightening us about all these issues.
Most welcome.
Dr. Jeevanan Jayendran, a consultant ENT surgeon, in our monthly open clinic segment on sleep issues this month on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.